Thank you very much, Julia. Good morning, everyone. First, I'd like to thank the organizer for putting on this wonderful conference. It's been a great few days. Hopefully, things don't start to change in the next hour or so. Like Julia said, the first few days, we've been talking about contextuality in a different way than I'll approach it. So we've been thinking about, there's been some nice talks about how to think about it, how to chop it up, how to axiomatize it, how to measure it, how to violate it, all this kind of neat stuff, okay? But today I'm going to be looking more about the applications, okay? This word on the end, of contextuality. Okay, so I'm going to be looking at an information theoretic task known as random access coding, and I'm going to be talking about how contextuality can offer an advantage, okay? Maybe a better way to say it is how limited you are if you restrict yourself to non-contextual models, okay? So I'm going to be talking about this work. It's a few years old now, with co-authors André Chaillou and Yordanis Karanidis here in Paris, and Sergi de Kundu, who's now a PhD student in Singapore. Okay. So here's the abstract. So you can decide whether you want to continue listening to me or work on your own talk or whatever you want to do. So I'm going to introduce random access coding, which I say is an information task. Okay. Then I'm going to introduce I'll just call them RACs, mostly out of habit. So a RAC-based non-contextuality inequality of Speckens, Buzicott, Quintoner, and Pride from around 2009. Okay, and this is going to be based on this information task. Then I'm going to show how some existing literature in quantum already gives you some small violations of this inequality. Okay. So to wrap up this work in one sentence, basically I'm going to show large violations by finding some large random access codes, okay? Whatever that means, okay? And to wrap it up in one word, this is the paper that was kind of our launching point, okay? By Rob and co-authors, and I just stick the word really there, okay? So 18 pages just to put that guy right there, all right? So if you have any questions at any time, just feel free to jump in. Random access codes. So this is kind of an information theoretic task. We have Alice who wants to kind of send some information to Bob in this particular kind of way. She has some bit string X. So N here is going to, for now in the rest of the talk, going to denote the length of the bit string that Alice is encoding. She sends into some state for purposes of introduction, just imagine it's a quantum state, and encodes X. Bob has some random index I, or let's just say any index I, okay? I could be from 1 to N, and he's going to measure the quantum state and try to find out the value of the ith bit of X, okay? He does not care about the rest, he's just going to measure, learn one bit of information that's encoded, of the n bits that were encoded, and the rest can go away for all he cares, okay? So some people think of this as a quantum phone book, okay? You just look up some bit of information, then you throw in the garbage, okay? For those of you who remember what phone books are, okay? So information theorists, what they usually care about, they have a bunch of different settings and scenarios, but usually, to sum it up, they care about the information carrying capacity of a qubit or multiple qubits. How much information can you squeeze into it? Okay, and once they solve it, then they change the problem and then solve a new one. All right, so there's Halevo's theorem bounding the accessible information. Then they said, hey, well, if we don't want the whole string, we only want a bit. Then Ashwin came along. He's at the Institute for Quantum Computing just down the road here. He proved that any quantum random access code that with decoding probability P, so let's say Bob is able to decode any bit with probability P, it has to have length at least this. So that means if you have N classical bits, this is how many qubits you need. Okay, so most people, H2 is just the binary entropy function. Okay, so just some function. So this is basically linear in N. So even though with quantum states and this kind of limited bit of information you want to get out, there's still not that much savings, okay, in terms of resources. Okay, and actually there are some classical ones, so Ashwin and co-authors came up with a classical way to do this with just an additive logarithmic factor. So it's basically the same. So that's what they care about. In this talk, we're not going to care so much about bounding the dimension or the, say, amount of resources. What we're going to do is restrict the encoding in a different kind of way that's going to be relevant for this conference. And that's going to have the cryptographic property known as parity obliviousness. Okay? Of course, you need to have some kind of restriction, or else Alice could just send X. Just post it on her Facebook or whatever. Bob gets X, and then he knows it. And then he can decode any bit he wants. And that's perfectly fine. Many of us do this. But we want it such that, you know, has some nice property. Okay? Something nice to work on. Okay, and what I look at is parity obliviousness. Okay. So we want Bob to be able to decode any bit he wants with high probability while maintaining that he cannot learn the subset, the parity of any subset of the bits at all. Okay? So let's say he can learn x1 with probability 90% or x2 with probability 90%, but he should not be able to learn the parity x1 plus x2. Okay? Which means that the probability overall measurement should be 1/2, which is the same as randomly guessing. Yep.
Do you need any subset of like 2 or?
Yes. Yes. 2, 3, all the way up to n. Yeah. So the singleton sets you can learn, and the empty set is not interesting. Yep. Okay, so do these exist? Am I asking too much? Well, they exist sometimes. So here's a way to encode 2 bits into a quantum state. I'm sure many of you have seen this before. It's a very nice example. So we have 2 bits, which means there's 4 possible values. So we need 4 quantum states to encode them. Okay. So if Alice had the string 00, this is the quantum state she would send to Bob. If she had 01, she would send this one, and so on and so forth. All right. And this is just the 01 plane. So this is just real valued qubits. If she wants the first bit, then she can just measure in this red basis here. And if you look at it for a few seconds, you'll see that, so if this corresponds to outcome 0, then it's quite close to the encoding of the states when the first bit is 0. Right here, whenever this corresponds to outcome 1, and we see it's quite close to whenever the first bit is 1. All right? The second, so if he wants to learn the first bit, he gets it with high probability. It's cos squared pi over 8. Okay? So these are all pi over 8, all these angles. Everything's cut up very nicely here. A fancy way of writing cos squared pi over 8 is this quantity right here. But Bob would not learn anything but the second bit. Okay, so it goes out. And if he wants to learn the second bit, instead of measuring in the red basis, he measures in the blue basis. And we can repeat the argument and see it's still cos squared pi over 8. Okay. Now, I wanted to talk about parity oblivious. Okay, so people have known this random access coding long before they started thinking about parity obliviousness. Okay, but it just so happens it works here. So, is it parity oblivious? Well, let's say, well, there's only 2 bits. So let's say Bob wants to learn x1 plus x2. Well, if you look at the reduced state, this corresponds to parity 0, and so does this one. Okay? And if they're given uniformly at random, we see that these, since these form a basis, you get the maximally mixed state. Okay? So that's the reduced state when the parity equals 0. But the reduced state when parity equals 1 is just this guy, which also gives you maximally mixed. Okay? So they're indistinguishable because they correspond to the same density operator. Okay? Here's another way to look at it. So now what I've done is taken the block sphere and I sliced it, and now this is an equatorial plane. Okay? And I have this square, the circumscribed inside. Okay? The corners of this square. Well, there's 4 of them, okay, so it is a random access encoding. Bob can measure in such a way that he learns any bit with this probability, and it's parity oblivious. Okay, so I just went from normal Euclidean space to block sphere space. Okay, and this is going to be handy. Because now, I was only using a small chunk of the block sphere, now we can use a larger chunk of the block sphere. Okay, and here, now we have a cube inside the sphere, and it's circumscribed, so the corners are touching the surface. And now we have 8 states. Okay. And you can show how to decode this with this probability right here. All right, so basically, in the 2 bits into 1 qubit, this was a 2, and now we have a 3. Okay? So by the principle of mathematical induction, you should just be able to keep going forever, right? So, can I stick a hypercube in there? So it seems to make sense. I just we went from 2 to 3 to 4. We're on a roll. Okay, does this make sense? Well, there's not really a good way to put 4 bits to encode into a single qubit. Okay, you can prove that you can only chop up the block sphere in so many chunks such that to put those so many states, 16 states. Okay, so at least one of them is going to be decoded with small probability. Okay, so it's not that good of an option. Okay, so, well, since it's a little crazy, I've put a 4-dimensional object in a 3-dimensional sphere, let's just have a larger, oh, there we go, there's the answer, you weren't paying attention. Let's just have a bigger block sphere. We went from a circle to sphere, why don't we just put a hypersphere? Okay, so does this work? Can we have a bigger block sphere? You know, seems okay, right? But something's weird, all right? These large dimensional block spheres are weird objects. Okay, I don't know if anyone has looked at them before, but you know, the block sphere just doesn't get bigger and bigger. Okay.
What do you mean technically by a bigger?
Oh, I don't mean anything technically. This is just very conceptual right now. I'm going to come back and answer this question.
Okay.
In fact, yeah, here's a quiz. How do you make these things work? Okay. So I'm going to be talking about the relationship to contextual models in a second. But if anyone's already familiar with that, here's a quiz for the next 5 minutes. Think about how to encode these 4 bits into some nice object that's kind of like a block sphere. Okay? And I'll come back and answer this in about 5 minutes. Okay, any questions so far about random access codes or what we're trying to accomplish? It's okay? All right? Okay, so non-contextual inequality violations. Okay, so this slide's going to have a bunch of words. Next one will be all the math. So what we're going to do is look at operation theories that define preparations and measurements. Okay, so this slide is going to be a quick rehash of what Rob was talking about on Monday. These operational ways to define preparation and measurement non-contextuality. So we're going to say that this model's preparation non-contextual. If any two preparations that yield the same statistics for all possible measurements are represented equivalently in the model. Okay? So in this talk, the last few days we've been talking about measurements. Like the focus has been on measurements, but today I'm only going to be concerned about preparation non-contextual. Okay? So that's preparation. The same thing with measurements, you just switch some words around, right? And NC inequality is any inequality on a probability distribution, assuming these guys. All right? So I'm going to get into, okay, you know, let me just say what it is. So here's the non-contextuality inequality by the paper I referenced before. In any operation theory that emits a preparation, okay, preparation, non-contextual hidden variable model, the average case decoding probability for any parity oblivious random access code is at most this right here. Okay, so I parentheses this off, so it's just 1 over n. Okay, but quantum mechanics violates this for n equals 2 and 3. Okay, the examples I showed you before, if you believe me that everything worked out, then we had square roots down there. Okay. Instead of 1 over 2, we had a 1 over square root 2. Instead of 1 over 3, we had 1 over square root 3. Okay? So we had already some small violations of this NC inequality by just digging up these old random access codes. Okay? So, here's a quick sketch of the proof before I continue. So Alice has some preparations X. Okay, so you have some states, lambda. These are the states that Alice is going to send to Bob. A preparation just takes in x here and assigns some probability distribution over creating these states. All right? And the measurement just takes, you know, whatever measurement you have, the state of which Bob is given, and assigns a probability distribution to the outcomes. All right? So random access coding is a really nice way because basically it's a prepare and measure scenario. Alice just prepares something, sends it, Bob measures it, gets an outcome. Okay, so all the bits you need to describe random access codes are exactly what's going on here. All right. So here is the preparation on contextuality. So to translate the words into math, for all measurements, if you're getting the exact same statistics, okay, they're operationally indistinguishable, then they're represented the same in the operational model. Okay. So now this is the connection between preparation non-contextuality and information theory. Right here we're saying that all measurements, two things are indistinguishable. Okay? In information theory, just think about quantum states or whatever you want. If two things are indistinguishable, every measurement you perform should not get you any information. That's what it means. In the random access code, that's what I meant for the parity to be oblivious. Okay? You cannot distinguish over all measurements. Okay? So we have two notions saying for all measurements something happens, and for all measurements something happens in the parity oblivious world. So if you start writing them down, parity oblivious basically means that if you look at the marginal distributions, such that the parity equals 0 and the parity equals 1, they should be the same. Okay, that's what indistinguishable means. Right. So if you combine the parity oblivious with the preparation on contextuality, you basically, a few lines later, you end up with this. So if the parity equals 0, the parity equals 1, okay? These probabilities are the same. So even if you knew exactly lambda, imagine it was just classical. Someone just gives you lambda. You know it exactly. Even with this extra information, you would not be able to tell the two probability distributions apart, whether you prepared one x or another. Okay? So what is this saying? Well, the parity oblivious operational level up here implies the same at the hidden variable level. So we've reduced it from talking about these operational level stuff to the classical sense. Okay? Now all you have to do is bound how well these random access codes do in the classical sense. Okay? And this part's actually easy to think about, so I'll just wave my hands. Imagine someone gives you a classical encoding of, say, the bit x1. Okay? Then you have some information about it. If someone else or in addition, you have some information about x2, then you have some information about the parity, right? So I believe you'll agree that you cannot have information, any positive amount of information about x1 and x2, or any pair of bits, okay? But it's okay if you have information about just a single bit, because then the parity will be unknown for the rest. So what if you wanted to maximize the decoding probability of Bob over here on average, but you're only allowed to send information about a single bit? Basically, all Alice has to do is just send that bit. So just say x1. Since everything's uniformly random, just say she sends x1. If Bob wants to learn x1, he learns it perfectly, obviously. If he wants to learn anything else, he has to randomly guess. Okay? And if you just look at this, that's exactly what this probability is here. So probability of learning one exactly and randomly guessing for the rest. Okay. So that's a quick sketch of the proof. Now what we're going to do is find violations for every n. Okay. I already said we had 2 and 3. Now let's work on 4, 5, and the rest. All right. Any questions so far? Okay, so we're going to revisit this fishy idea. Now we have this hypercube in a hypersphere. And here's a fun fact. These large dimensional block spheres kind of exist in a neat sort of way. Okay, and that's a theorem. You could take that to the bank. We're going to figure out what this actually means. And we're going to look at this nice operational model called hyperbits. Okay? Hyperbits are for those bold people who want to look at these large dimensional block spheres. So now we have a unit vector in RD. Okay? So any dimension we want. And Bob has some measurement x, corresponding to outcomes plus minus 1. And he associates these measurements with some unit vector also living in this d-dimensional space. And the expectation of the outcome is given by the inner product. Okay? So it's basically how you would start thinking about block spheres in higher dimensions. Okay? And everything I said about hyperbits is in this nice paper here. So hyperbits. What's up with hyperbits? So here's a random access encoding example that has to do with hyperbits. So I'm just going to define it by an example here. Suppose you had 0, 1, 0, 1. You need to encode this in a unit vector. So when you see a 0, you put a plus 1. When you see a 1, you put a minus 1. Okay? So now you have these plus 1, minus 1 vector. You normalize it. Okay? Because that's the rule. And the measurement is basically these standard basis vectors. Okay? If Bob wants to learn the second bit, he just measures with this unit vector. If you want to learn the first bit, you put the 1 there instead. And so on. And if you do this, the expectation, well, you can work it out. It's just the inner product. But basically, going from expectation back to probability, you can work this out, and you get exactly something closer to what we wanted. Okay, we had 1 half plus 1 half, 1 over root n. Okay, in the classical or non-contextual model, we had this 1 over n, and now we have 1 over root n. Okay. So these hyperbits are violating our non-contextuality inequality.
Yeah. Inequality tends towards the quantum bits, for qubits.
The theorem was for any non-contextual hidden variable model. That's right. The only parameter in the inequality was n, which was the number of bits you're encoding.
Yeah. But nothing about the system there.
Nothing about the system, nothing about the dimension. It's really just the number of bits you're encoding. So now this violates it, okay? So that's nice. Let's see if we can make these a little bit more quantum, okay? So these hyperbits are really neat, but are they quantum? And moreover, I haven't mentioned whether they're parity oblivious, okay? We need at least the parity oblivious part to violate the NC inequality, okay? So let's work on these two things. So is it quantum? Well, hyperbits can be simulated quantumly, okay, using entanglement and one classical bit of communication. Okay? So it's quite different than the block sphere encoding we had before. So since these large dimensional block spheres don't exist in the quantum land, we have to do some kind of extra work. Okay? So with the help of entanglement and a little bit of classical communication. And I'm going to dig into the details a little bit later, but for now, just trust me that this is indeed quantum. Okay? And this part I found really neat. So there's learning probabilities. You can define learning probabilities in the hyperbit model as well. And they translate directly over to the quantum. But basically, we're going to look at this probability right here. So 1 half is the base probability. That's randomly guessing. But suppose we add this extra parameter alpha s here. So if alpha s is positive, then you're learning something. And this is the probability of learning the parity of any subset s. Okay, whether it's the singleton sets, 2 or larger. And what you can show, just by having fun with vectors, is that if you sum over all subsets that are non-empty, then this alpha s squared here is less than or equal to 1. Okay?
That includes the singleton sets?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going with it. So let's just shove that. Whoop. Yeah, so these guys, they actually prove something slightly more general, Okay? So it's not that I just dug up this paper and everything was answered for me and I rewrote it. Okay? They proved a lot of neat things, and it's a very nice paper. It's a funny title, but you know, I recommend people having a look. So they proved something a little more general that just happened to work for us. Is there a question? Okay, so as Rob said, this also works for the singleton sets. But the example I had before, the singleton sets, this quantity was 1 over root n. Okay? Now, whenever you sum over the singleton sets and you stick in 1 over root n here, you already achieve 1. Okay? And so now when you sum over the rest of the sets, there are a bunch of non-negative things that add to 0 because there's no more space left for them, so they all have to be 0. Okay? So once you have alpha s equals 0, you just plug it in there, and now the probability of learning any subset, the parity of any subset, is now 1/2, which means they're all hidden. Okay? So this was really neat. It's kind of worked like magic, actually. So it is a parity of oblivious random access code. Okay? And the learning probabilities are preserved when we take this to the quantum level as well. Okay? So the construction is complete. It's parity oblivious, it's quantum. It has a high success of decoding. So in that, success probability is higher than the limit of the non-contextuality inequality. So now we have a large violation. And it works for any n. So in a sense, we're done. Although, you know, don't feel cheated because I actually didn't tell you what the quantum encodings are. Okay, I just said, you know, believe me, they're quantum, blah, blah, blah. But before I get into the construction, I want to first prove they're optimal. Okay, and after this proof, the construction will make a lot more sense. So what do I mean by proving it's optimal? Well, I had a random access code and the decoding probability was quite large, but now I want to say you can't get any larger. Okay? There are limitations, even in the quantum world, on the success probability if you have parity oblivious. So what we actually do is prove a relaxation. Okay? For most of the talk, I've been talking about average case decoding probability, but our random access code will actually work in the worst case as well. Okay? So it depends on whichever one you want, but basically most of the theorems hold for average. So we prove something slightly stronger over there, but this is the relaxation here, is that we only care about even parity oblivious now. So the subset of any bits, an even number of them. So let's say the first 2 or the first 4, whatever. Okay? The parity of the first 3 do not have to be hidden any longer. And we're going to show an upper bound on the success probability of decoding these such things. And since we have more flexibility, this will also be an upper bound if you want them all hidden. Okay? And we actually need to look at this even parity oblivious. Like, we didn't intend on relaxing. It's just the proof and the way we went about it. The even parity obliviousness was an artifact of the proof. Okay? It's still something kind of mysterious going on there. So how do we prove this optimal thing? Well, a moment's thought, you think it's a hard task, right? You can't just optimize over all encodings, especially if you don't bound the dimension. So what we're going to do is translate it over to an XOR game. And XOR games are something nice that we can bound. So XOR games. I'm sure many of you have seen this before, but just to establish some notation, Alice and Bob, they're going to start with some entangled state that doesn't depend on their inputs, X and Y, and Alice and Bob are going to output A and B. Okay, this is a different Alice and Bob now because they're playing a non-local game. And they win the game if the XOR of A and B is equal to some function of X and Y, some 0, 1 valued function. Okay. And now some quantity of merit for an XOR game is, if you range over all strategies, doesn't matter the dimension of the quantum state or whatever, as long as Alice and Bob know the probabilities of which X and Y are sampled, and they also know the function here, f, what's the maximum probability they can win this game? Okay. So, you know, this is another setting where we want the maximum probability of Alice and Bob achieving something. Okay. What does this have to do with random access codes? Well, we're going to look at a particular XOR game called the index game. So Alice has some string X, Bob has some string, some index Y, so an index of the bits of the string, and they win the game if A plus B is the Yth bit of X. Okay? So I really wanted a Y here, so now I'm using Y as an index. Okay, before I used I, now it's Y. So this is a sort of distributed version of random access code, right? He only wants to learn one of the bits of X, okay? But now there's no communication. So now Alice has to do her part. So Alice's output has to help Bob get there. Okay, so this is the index game. Any questions about this?
When you say Bob learns to teach, I might imagine that Alice's output sent to Bob, and then he's the one.
That's going to be something that's going to happen on a future slide. Yeah. But right now, Alice is just going to do her part and keep it, and then the XOR has to be this. So you can imagine a referee who's going to take them. Okay, so let's look at a small index game example. So Alice has two bits. Bob wants to learn one of them. So Bob, if he chooses the first, then they win the game if A plus B equals the first of Alice's bits. And if Y equals 1, I guess I should put 0, 1 up there, then he wants to learn the second. Does someone see the optimal value of this game? I think. Yeah, no signaling or just good old fashioned XOR game. Okay, I'll give you guys a few hints. What if Alice here changes her output to A prime and just takes X0 and outputs this instead? Now what Bob has to do is output the same thing as Alice. If he inputs 0 or if he has an input 1, he has to output this piece right here. Okay, one more simplification. Just define X prime to be the XOR, the two bits. And now you have something that looks a lot like CHSH. Okay? So the maximum probability they can win this game is the same as CHSH, which is, oh, there, CHSH. Which is exactly this quantity here, cos squared pi over 8. Okay? So I spent some time some years ago just going through quantum literature trying to find cos squared pi over 8. And anytime I saw cos squared pi over 8, like, that's CHSH. Okay, so that's what I did here. And this is what I did with this. Here we have a random access coding of two bits into a qubit, and the success probability is this, and CHSH is the same. Okay? Now, is there a coincidence? Maybe. Well, no. I proved no. These things are actually equivalent. Okay? So there was no coincidence that those two values were the same. As long as one value, if you knew the optimum value of one, you knew the other, and vice versa. Okay? But that was just for two well-known cases of the small random access code and CHSH. You know, people have studied these for a while. But now we can extend it for any n. So there exists a quantum even parity oblivious random access code with average decoding probability p, if and only if there exists a quantum index strategy with winning probability p. Okay, so the probabilities are preserved on both sides. Okay. Here's a sketch of the proof. I'll show one of the directions on the next slide, but just so you have an idea of what's going on. So Alice has some game input X and outputs A. And now, from this, we're going to define the random access encoding of a different string, S, here. So if A equals 0, then she's going to prepare the state encoding X. If A equals 1, then all the bits of X get flipped. Okay, so bold A is just all zeros or all ones, depending on A. And then the random access encoding that we're going to make is for the complementary string. Okay? If we do this and have this correspondence, then hiding the even parities of S also hides those of X. Okay? Because the even parities, basically, you just write them out, and the A's are all going to cancel. Okay? And now, by no signaling, Bob does not know any information about X, so he cannot know the same information about S. Okay? And that's why we want it even. It could be the case that A here encodes something about the odd parities. Okay? And we spent some time, and we cannot get around this. So even parity obliviousness is key here. Okay, so let me show one direction of the proof, how we actually go about these things. We're going to have a random X, the encoding of some string X here, and then we're going to purify it. So Alice is going to keep a part of it. And then she's going to take the equal superposition of that encoding or the encoding over here when all the bits are flipped. Okay? And this is basically going to be your outcome A. Okay? So it's just so A here is going to be equal chance of getting a 0 and 1, and then there's going to be some post-measured state on Bob's side. What's neat is this, if you have the state omega X here, if Bob is given his share of it, it encodes no information about X. Okay? And this is from even parity oblivious. So you start writing down the reduced states, you start throwing in that everything has to be even parity oblivious, and Bob's left with no information about X at all. Okay, so that's where that comes in. And now this is going to let you set up something non-locally, because they just start with some of them, some state here, omega zero, as long as they both know what it is, doesn't matter. Then they get their inputs, X and Y. Since this does not depend on X at all, Alice has a local unitary on her side to map it to omega x. Okay? And this doesn't require any signaling or anything. Everything's local. Alice measures to get A, and depending on her outcome, A, Bob will have a random access encoding of one or the other, of x or the complement. So Bob just measures as he would in the random access code, and he gets some value, and you just check, and everything works out. So the success probability of the random access code corresponds exactly to this index strategy here, and that gives you some probability P. Okay. And the other one, I won't do it, it's quite similar. So index track is very similar. But there's two kind of independent things going on here. In both cases, the success probability is being mapped to the success probability, so those things are tightly connected. But the even parity obliviousness of the random access code gets mapped to no signaling in the other model. Okay? So here, the proof I just showed, this allowed you not to signal. And if you go the opposite direction, the no signaling principle will force Bob not to be able to learn anything but the even parities. Okay, so those two ideas are connected. Okay. So now they win the game if this happens. So now we can just plug this into a computer, use Cyrilson's theorem and some semi-definite programming by William and co-authors. You could just ask your computer to solve this. It can do it efficiently. It'll give you upper and lower bounds, okay, and they should match if your computer does what it's supposed to. But it doesn't work for any n. So you just ask it to solve for n equals 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you stare at it for a few hours, you do some pattern searching, and then you can come up with some general solution. Okay, so this is a quite straightforward way to actually bound an XOR game. Okay, so you can prove that this is the optimal probability for the XOR game, and through the equivalence, this means that any parity oblivious random access code cannot do any better than this either. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, so now that we have the connection to XOR games, This is a much nicer way to give the explicit encoding. So Alice is going to create a bunch of VPR pairs and measure the first halves with some observable AX. Okay, these observables are a little scary, so there's a whole slide dedicated to them. But just trust me, they exist. And you get an outcome plus or minus one. She sends the second halves and now A to Bob, like you said. And the decoding procedure is Bob wishes to learn XT. So I'm now on my third different index here. So he wants to learn XT. If he wants to do this, he has his own observable that depends on T, BT. He gets an outcome plus or minus one. Okay, so now he has plus or minus one. He has A from Alice. So he can put them together, and if they're the same, he outputs plus one. Let's see. We want him outputting 0 or 1, because it's a bit. So if they're the same, then he outputs 0. Otherwise, he outputs 1. Okay, so he just checks if they're the same or not. And if you choose the observables in a clever way, then the expectation over this C here is exactly what we want. Okay, so you just work it out and blah, blah, blah. And you get the decoding probability is exactly this. Okay. So this is how you construct the observables AX and BT. So it's basically Searlson's construction when he was looking at all these C systems and XR game stuff. Okay, and this also has connections to these Clifford algebras. But we need two observables. For the case of two, we need three for the case of three, so we'll just use these polymatrices. And then we just define them recursively if you want them to get larger. So you just, for n even, you just tack an x on the end. And for the new guy, you just let it be that. And you know, for n odd, you go back a couple of steps, stick x's, and define these. Okay, just a bunch of polymatrices. Okay, and then if, since they share an EPR pair, calculating these inner products are quite straightforward. Okay, so now we have all these nice polymatrices and these tensor products. If Alice has the string X, she just looks at this linear combination of these matrices, these G matrices. Okay, and they do depend on X here. And right here, Bob is just going to take one of them and take its transpose because just the way the math works out. And if you look at the inner products and calculate everything, the expectation is exactly what you want. Okay, it's just like in the reduction from XOR games to these C systems and semi-definite programs. Okay, so if you're familiar with Searlson's work, this is just using that. In general, you can use any hyperbit you want here. So the hyperbit gives you the linear combination. So the Searlson's work is also tied closely to these hyperbits.
Seems to me that the different G and I's are defined in different Hilbert spaces. G and 1.
Yeah, so you fix N.
Is there an implicit tensor identity on everything else? Is that?
Well, it's recursive. So you're going to start with these X, Y, Z's. And then if you have a larger N, then you're just going to take the old set and tensor something on them. So this identity is over whatever space this lives on. So once you fix N, then all the states are on the same space. Yeah, but you're only worried about one n at a time. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, I have a few minutes left. I want to talk a bit about device independence. So unfortunately, after hearing the last few days, this isn't device independent test of contextuality. It's a device independent test of the cryptographic property of parity obliviousness. Okay, so I just want to throw that out there real quick. So can we make these random access codes device independent? Okay, what does that mean, or why should we care? Well, this is before we just had Alice sending the states. But you know, she's not a wizard, she just doesn't create these states. You know, you have something creating the states for you. Some computer or quantum computer or whatever. So this is the real world, at least in my head. What if you don't trust the preparation device? Okay, everything was about the preparations, so now let's just talk about the preparation device. So if you don't trust the preparation device, you have it looks like this. So now you have no idea what this computer is doing. Okay, Some people might disagree. Of course, you know, Facebook could be have malware in there, and you have to watch 10 minutes of ads before you even get your quantum state. More seriously, maybe the quantum device is a little more open sourcey, and maybe Bob has hacked into it, or maybe Bob is the one who sold Alice the computer. So now we have evil Bob. He's hacked into Alice's open source quantum computer. And now, whenever Alice inputs X, he just gets the whole state X. Okay, and he can measure this and perfectly learn X, and Bob's happy. Okay? So this was his plan all along, was to learn. Now he knows the whole state, not just the even parities. Okay, so too much information is going. So can we fix this? Well, we can, in a sense, if we go back to this non-local-ish way to do the random access encoding. Okay, so this is one way to do it. So Alice created these EPR pairs. She did some kind of measurement. Then she sent A along. And then Bob measured, did something with A, and outputted the bit he wanted. Okay. Now, if you want to change this, the part in the square satisfies no signaling. There's no communication. So instead of Alice trusting Bob to do what he was supposed to do with A, she just does it on her side instead. Okay, so she just changes the coding from X to S. Remember, Bob was basically just supposed to do this with his state, so Alice might as well do it. So now she's encoding this string S here, and Bob can just measure as in the random access code and output whatever he wants. And now there's no communication, okay? Other than Alice preparing this state and sending it over. Okay? But, you know, of course, Bob may have some influence. Maybe she prepared some other state and sent it over. So this is what it looks like in the device independent model. There's no communication at all here. Alice is going to measure A and output this new string S, and Bob is going to measure and output some guess for SY. Okay? So there's no communications, and no signaling is going to make sure that he has no information but the even parities of S, or X for that matter. Okay? And it doesn't matter how you, what's happening with the preparation device. It's just no signaling. So even if Bob is super quantum, as long as he satisfies the no signaling principle, then he cannot cheat. Okay, so that was a little bit of device-independent cryptography. Here's some discussion bait. Maybe someone might care about this. So I kept talking about even parity obliviousness, and it seems like this might be the most important thing. Why did I talk about parity oblivious if in the proof I only bound it for even parity? Okay. Well, if Alice just sends the majority bit, then you have this success probability of Bob learning the correct bit in your random access code. Okay? But the majority bit is classical. Like there's no quantum encoding or any other kind of encoding going on. Okay? And this success probability is the same basically as the quantum one. All right? We have a root 2 over pi here, so we have some constant that's less than 1, but it's not that much less than 1. So it's basically 1 half plus something 1 over root n. Okay. And the majority bit actually hides the even parities. Okay. It might take a few minutes, but you should be able to convince yourself of this. So we actually do need full parity obliviousness. We can't just have even parity obliviousness. Okay? But if you have even parity, like does preparation contextuality power this? Okay? Like maybe it does a little bit, but not as much as you have full parity obliviousness. Okay? And I think the original proof of Rob and co-authors, I think it works if you just have the even parities. I haven't fully checked, but had a quick look, it looks like it does. So looks like you have a little bit of powering there by contextuality. And what if you want odd? Now, odd is a funny beast. So now, well, the way I think about odd is that it hides the parities of 3, 5, 7, so forth, not the singletons. And then you can have very high decoding probabilities. And you can do much better than just even by itself. Okay, so the reduction from full to even didn't buy anything, but going to odd buys you a lot. So what's happening with that? Okay, so I'm out of time. So I just want to say that we took the popular quantum random access codes and extended them to higher dimensions, okay, by using these hyperbits and some nice work by Cyrilson. And they provide the large violation of this non-contextuality inequality. And in the proof, proving it's optimal, then we needed non-locality. And there was some kind of connections to even parity obliviousness. Okay? And we're able to make this device independent using the non-locality part. Okay? And that's it. Thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Jamie, for the very nice talk. So we have time for questions.
The reason you focus on the even parity proofs is because that allows you to prove optimality. But it would I be correct in summarizing that for the sort of hyperbit of communication,
mm-hmm.
Your proof of large non-contextuality violation is unquestioned.
Yes.
It's just possibly the violation could be even more.
That's right.
And that's open.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's right. And we didn't want even parity obliviousness. Like, it was just, we tried really hard to get rid of this assumption because we didn't really like it. It seemed, the more adjectives you stick on things. But it was just an artifact of the proof. It just, for some reason, when you look at the no signaling principle and all the connections, you just needed it. Yeah. But luckily for us, it was the same upper bound. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this a simple quantum example of a protocol that's, say for n is equal to 3,
mm-hmm.
it's even parity oblivious, but not parity oblivious overall. So the cube code for the 3 bits,
mm-hmm.
the even parities for 2 bits is just the fact that the, mixture of something like, a square along this diagonal or a square along that diagonal coincide.
Yeah.
And you consider all the diagonals. But then the three-way parity is basically a tetrahedron, which is sort of these two vertices of the cube and these two vertices of the cube.
Oh, I see.
Versus the other tetrahedron.
Yeah.
And those also average to the completely mixed state.
Yeah, right.
And so it's also oblivious for the three bits.
That's right.
And so I'm just curious, do you have in mind like a simple construction that would clearly be oblivious for the pairwise parities, but not for the triplewise parities? So I can sort of start.
So simpler in the sense of like a smaller dimension or just simpler construction?
Well, the example I just gave is oblivious for
mm-hmm.
the three-way parity.
That's right, that's right.
So I'm hoping for one that isn't, just to give me a notion of, is that an interesting concept here?
Well, that are oblivious
for even but not for odd?
The simplest one is actually just the classical one where you just send the majority.
I see, okay.
If you send the majority, it's not going to hide the three parities.
But there are no specific quantum constructions that sort of achieve the pairwise parity obliviousness by virtue of everything mixing to the same states, but the appropriate mixtures of the...
I can't think of something nice geometrically, like the way you're describing it.
Okay.
But if you take any strategy for the index game, it will give you something even, and unless you have a really good strategy, if it's a suboptimal strategy, imagine it's going to leak information with the odd parities. So that is a generic way to do it. But yeah, it's interesting. I'd have to think about it.
Any other question? I had a little bit of curiosity. That's,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even call it a question. But when you asked it about like higher dimensional block spheres and generalization, so I had this curiosity of like
mm-hmm.
what you meant, and you did mean this hyperbit.
There
would be another kind of natural quantum candidate for that.
Okay.
That would be like the states that you can get in the symmetric subspace of n qubits, like the spin coherent states, they
okay.
be like block spheres, you can really describe states as directions on the sphere.
Mm-hmm. Are they like a full sphere?
Full
no
sphere,
holes?
Full
no.
Holes on that.
Okay.
They are really geometrically
yeah.
Three-dimensional spheres, like the block spheres are just bigger, as you said.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the distinguishable states are only the ones of the antipodes, but the dimension of the vectors, the underlying vector space is larger, the dimension of the symmetric subspace. So I guess probably the answer is that you haven't thought about it.
No.
I was wondering whether, what can one say about those fields, if there is a random access scope that can be just put there geometrically, or whether there is some bound that says that you can.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice to see if you start putting these hypercubes, circumscribing these spheres, what kind of properties they have. I'm sure they'd have some nice properties. Sounds like
the dimension of this gross B, yeah, this is the dimension of the
hyper B
that
grows exponentially. Well, as long as it grows, because the flux sphere does.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's good.
One more question.
Yep.
Sorry, there's a part of your talk that I didn't quite follow, which was sort of the step from the proof of how well you do for hyperbits to you could do also this well with quantum. So the hyperbits are this post-quantum theory. And then was it that you proved an upper bound on the hyperbits and then showed that it could be saturated by quantum? Or what was the logic?
We had a construction using the hyperbits.
Right.
And then
you turned that into a quantum construction?
Yeah, by using this paper, the hyperbit paper, basically. It's not trivial. There's a lot going on. It's basically Cyrilson type business. So that was construction. We just wanted to know whether you could exceed it. So we went from hyperbits to quantum. Then we said, with quantum alone, can we do better? Like maybe you can have even larger violations. And that was impossible. Yeah, through these XOR games.
So the translation from hyperbit constructions to quantum constructions.
Yeah. It's exactly this thing I showed at the end. So I just, this right here. Right here, you have these observables AX, blah, blah, blah. And right here, my hyperbit encoding is hiding here. You have these plus minus one vectors. And then the normalization's out here. But if you just put a different hyperbit here, and I believe you keep the same B there, and then you take the expectation and all that stuff, you get exactly what you want. So from going from hyperbits to quantum, this is the construction, and all the learning probabilities and everything is preserved.
It sounds almost as if you're saying I can simulate hyperbit probabilities in quantum mechanics, but that obviously can't be true, because isn't the hyperbit theory more general?
I believe you can simulate it, yeah. You just set up this non-local game type scenario, you have entanglement, you do some measurements, and then you just send the outcome of the measurement. That way they know what the state, Bob knows exactly what state it has collapsed to.
Is the quantum encoding of higher dimension than the hyperbit?
Yes, yeah.
So
you just have larger number of EPR pairs.
I see.
And then use these different observables on the sides. That, and these observables grow as well.
So just for a higher bit of dimension n, with n possible direction, you need n
over two EPR pairs.
N over two.
Yeah. Round it down.
So you're simulating it in a higher dimensional quantum.
So that's right. Yeah, so information theorists would not like the dimension here, because I'm really using a large dimension, but I'm maintaining parity of obliviousness. So you kind of need lots of dimensions to do this. Yeah.
Okay, is there any other questions? If not, thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.